And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, October 20th. Derek Van Riper here with Keith Law on this episode. We'll get caught up on both of the league championship series, both of which became more interesting on Thursday with the Diamondbacks and Astros picking up wins. We're going to talk about Keith's trip to the Arizona Fall League, a lot of prospects that he had a chance to see during his time there, so we'll break a few of those players down here over the course of this episode. But Keith, we have to begin today in the NLCS. Game 3, Brandon Pfaadt comes out and pitches really well against the Phillies lineup that has just been on fire. The Diamondbacks had a plan, and they stuck to it. They took him out after he faced 18 batters. They didn't want him to see the lineup a third time. 9 strikeouts, no walks over 5 2/3 scoreless innings. Is this smart baseball? I saw in Jason Stark's piece today, he actually asked Torey Lovullo, the manager of the Diamondbacks, after the game, if you were sitting in the stands, would you have booed yourself? And Torey Lovullo said, absolutely. I would have thought the manager lost his absolute mind for sure. And yeah, I was booing myself as I walked out to the mound. I didn't need to be in the stands, which, you know, again, they had a plan and they stuck to it. But is this smart baseball? Is the harsh avoidance of the third time through the order always a good idea? I think the last time this really came up in mass was Blake Snell getting pulled by the Rays 3 years ago in the World Series, right? That was the last time this came up. And there's a pretty big difference in Blake Snell at that point in his career and Brandon Pfaadt at this point in his career, too. Yeah. I mean, I think there's all these other factors that should be in play. Who is the pitcher? Who is the opponent? Like, I think those things do matter as far as making that decision. But was this a good process and a good decision by the Diamondbacks?
Yes. Yes. Unequivocally, yes. As soon as he got Rojas, it was like, great, take him out. Take him out. He did his job. He absolutely did his job. You know, Pfaadt had, you know, at one point, he actually brought his ERA down quite a bit, but he still had a 5.7 on the season. Now, if you look, he got bombed his first couple of outings in the big leagues. First two, and then went back down, came up for another one, gave up 6 runs in 2 innings. He had a 9.82 ERA at the All-Star break and was back in the minors at that point. So he brought it down 4 runs. And 2 of his last 3 outings in September, he didn't give up any runs. Obviously, he's been very good in the postseason. So you could argue like, he's made some adjustments, right? He does look a little bit different. He's definitely getting better results on overall results and better results, I think, leading up the fastball. But this was their third starter, right? This was in a guy who, very young, inexperienced, hasn't worked deep into a ton of games. You just got 6-ish innings, elite, like as good as it could possibly be innings out of the guy. You have 2 good reasons to take him out. One is we know the times through the order penalty is very real. It got Zach Wheeler, who's one of the best guys and best pitchers in baseball. The one game the Phillies had lost in the playoffs before Thursday night was because Thompson rode Wheeler too long. And I think it was the third time through the order that Wheeler got stung and it ended up 4-3. And then Hoffman, which I was fine bringing Jeff Hoffman, and he gives up the home run that cost them that particular game against Atlanta. But this, the time through the order thing is real and it affects everybody. Now, if the Diamondbacks had been up 6-0, maybe that's a different scenario. And you say, we'll ride him a little bit batter by batter, see how he's doing. But the game was tied, 0-0. And coming right up, you had left, right? Schwarber, Turner, Harper. So you also have a pretty good argument, not just to change the pitcher because of the times through the order penalty, but to try to go get the platoon advantage for the next 3 batters, bring in a lefty, which is what they did. So this was good sense across the board. I think it was Ron Darling on that broadcast who was just old man yelling at Cloud about this. And you know, that's just, this is automatic and they're not managing and there's no thought. It's like, there's a ton of thought that goes into this. It's acknowledging reality. Like, this is the kind of thing, you know, I think Earl Weaver, who has a reputation, not just as a great manager, but people tend to think of him as very old school. But most of the big decisions he made, most of the strategies he either came up with or popularized, they were based on data, based on evidence. He was limited at the time, but he would, learn what he could and manage accordingly. And that's what this is. This is just recognizing that, hey, every pitcher's worse three times the third time through the order, and even worse than that, the fourth time when it comes up. So it doesn't mean you pull the guy automatically. And I don't think that's what happened last night, but it was nothing. And at that point, well, hey, you're trying to keep the score tied. You have a much better chance to do so, avoiding the times through the order penalty and gaining the platoon advantage with a fresh arm out of the bullpen. And I think Lavulo managed it right. I think he outmanaged Thompson. And that's, to me, that was the difference in the game, was he managed his bullpen extremely well. And Thompson made one or two mistakes, particularly his over-reliance on Kimbrell. We can talk about that, but that's just you knew that was going to sink him at some point, and it got him on Thursday night. And to me, that was the biggest difference is, all credit to Thott, obviously, but Lavulo managed really well and Thompson made a couple of miscues.
Yeah, so I think for me, the part that was a little harder, I'm 100% with you on the third time to the order penalty. That's absolutely real. The matchup part of it that made me unsure of that decision and made my snap reaction say, I would have let Brandon Thott go one more, even though it was the third time he would have faced Kyle Schwarber, is that Andrew Salfrank was the lefty. And I don't think of Andrew Salfrank as this guy that comes in and is just overpowering and great. It's still the platoon advantage, like you said, so that matters. You go lefty-lefty in that spot. I think he walked Schwarber and then got Turner. That was the matchup that I would have been afraid of, is if Schwarber gets on against Salfrank, do I want Salfrank to have to pitch to Turner, or would I rather take the chances with Thott against Schwarber and then make a pitching change if Schwarber got on and go with a righty? But then you'd have to go righty-lefty against Bryce Harper, right? So it's not an easy decision. Like, you're going to get a matchup you don't love. It's right. One of those options. And based on the math, avoiding that third time to the order penalty has been kind of proven to be the best sort of outcome. But it's still counterintuitive, I think. Even if you understand it, in the moment you're watching it, you're like, oh, let him keep going. Let's just see how long this happens. But this is like people, like they burn cookies. They go on heaters at the blackjack table and lose because they don't get up. They don't leave. Like, all these things we do, like, we get this momentum and we should walk away, and we don't.
And we don't.
That's what tends to happen.
Yeah. Oh, that's absolutely it. That is, I always say this guy is dealing, such and such a pitcher, Zach Wheeler was dealing until he wasn't.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't go on for, nothing goes on forever, right? The sun is going to burn itself out at some point. Wheeler was absolutely dealing. That is not predictive. It doesn't mean he's going to keep dealing, particularly as you get multiple times through the order. He gets, the assumption is the pitcher just gets fatigued and the hitters get more comfortable. They've seen him before in the game. The pitcher has to have maybe a second, third, fourth different plan to get certain hitters out. And I think you're absolutely right about the matchup problem. I mean, this is one reason why this Phillies lineup is so good and so difficult. It's that they're, not only do they do the left, right, whatever, that's not the cleverest thing, but those guys are all pretty good, right? They're all pretty tough. So yeah, okay, you can bring in a lefty and you'll definitely get an advantage against Schwarber and Harper. Get a lefty, especially he's got a low slider, can really spin a slider maybe, but then you've got to deal with Turner. And right now it's Bohm hitting fourth. It really should be Castellanos, but that is, the Phillies can get you either way. And I think that just increases the challenge for opposing managers trying to figure out a way through the lineup and makes it, it does make it difficult. You had to deal with Salfrank potentially facing Turner with a man on if he doesn't get Schwarber out. I prefer that to having Thott potentially give up a homer to Schwarber third time through. That was the thing in my head, was Thott's, has been a little homer prone. And he's been even more homer prone to lefties than he has to righties. Now he's going to face Schwarber for the third time. I would get him out of there and get a lefty in and sort of work, you know, it's get this next guy and then we'll worry about what's next if he gets this guy out.
One other part of this that's really challenging is that a player's splits, like I think career splits, right? Lefty lefty to me matters over a long period of time.
Yeah.
It does not matter over a couple of weeks. It does not matter even within a season because statistically there isn't enough sample for it to be meaningful, right? So you think about someone like Bryce Harper and you pull up his career splits against lefties. Bryce Harper, this is not going to surprise people, is actually pretty good against lefties. Hits 264, the 363 OBP, slugs 463. It's a 122 WRC plus. He's a well above average hitter, lefty on lefty. That's Bryce Harper, right? What do you think Kyle Schwarber's career splits against lefties look like without looking?
I would guess he had a pretty big split. My assumption is like it's a 200-point OPS split.
It's probably about that because his numbers against lefties,
okay.
204, 320, 382 slug, 32.6% K rate, right? So you've got about a 1-in-3 shot of striking him out lefty-lefty.
Yeah, he does not like the left-handed breaking ball. Yeah.
Right. It's a 93 WRC plus. So again, you think about like, okay, like lefty lefty, it's not always equal in terms of how much of a benefit you get from it. But Schwarber is a lefty who has shown us a lot less against same-handed pitching over the course of his career than Bryce Harper. So you do have to think about the matchups in that regard. I think you're right. 200, a 200 point difference in OBP compared to his righty split. That's probably about right for Schwarber. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty confident in that. Those are other parts of the equation too. Is like, when are we going to try and take advantage of that matchup? If we're going to use Sol Frank at all, we're going to use him here because we like this spot. This is the optimal usage of a guy that has not struck out a lot of batters during his brief time in the big leagues, but he might be more likely to get a strikeout because of who he's facing in this particular matchup.
Yep. I think Kostat really closed his platoon split quite a bit this year. It's one year split data. And I agree with you. It's a small sample, but we only have 2 years with him too. And so you could at least say, well, this year was better than last year. That might be something. I mean, who else, you know, saving a lefty specifically for Marsh. Also, it's possible that Thompson would pull Marsh and put in Pache or somebody else to pinch hit. There's Schwarber is the guy in the lineup you bring in the lefty for. Right. That is, he's the best. If you have a tactical lefty, I mean, there's no such thing as a lefty specialist really anymore because of the change in the rules of having to face three batters. However, Sol Frank is kind of that guy. And that's who you use, right? That is exactly Schwarber is the guy in the Phillies lineup you want to deploy him for most.
And for what it's worth, Sol Frank's strikeout rates throughout his time at every other level were a lot better than what he's done in his brief time in the big leagues. There's probably some give there, right? Like he's probably not a 15% strikeout rate pitcher,
right?
True talent. We've only seen him for a dozen innings and change so far at the big league level. So all of that has to be sort of baked into a decision like this as well.
I'll just point out real quick too. Each team has a guy who I think they both came up in like mid-September. Ryan Kirkering, Andrew Sol Frank, both pretty important. So far, Kirkering didn't have a great night last night. I mean, he wasn't the worst Phillies reliever, but had some trouble getting stuff down and gave up a couple of hits for it. But I do think it's very interesting, and to both teams' credit, that they're saying, no, it's the best guy for the job right now. In Kirkering had pitched extremely well in the postseason until last night's outing, too. So good for Thompson for trusting him. I hope last night doesn't change things too much.
Right. I think internally you have to look at things like the quality of a pitcher's arsenal. And then, of course, as a team, you know if someone's ready for that opportunity, use your best relievers in these spots. Do you think there's an added benefit to bringing up someone like Kirkering, like Sol Frank, who the big league hitters just haven't seen? Like, is there a little extra juice that you get as a pitcher that just hasn't been out there facing major league hitters all season long?
Yeah, if it's a guy who's got something unusual or novel about him, right? A different delivery, a particularly unusual pitch. I mean, Kirkering's got really high spin on basically everything he throws, right? So to me, that is a perfect guy for exactly what you're describing, right? Like, let's get all the unusual guys you can bring up. Well, I obviously can't bring up guys like you used to be able to, or you can bring up two or three more guys at this point in September, but still, those are the guys you want to consider. There's tactical value because there's something different, a funky delivery, a low slot, anything like that. Bringing up your generic, we're going to talk about Fall League. Fall League was full this year, was full of guys throwing 89, 92 with below average command. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. Like, we're talking about guys who, think of David Price when he came up. I don't know if you, he was, I think, feel like he comes up a lot in these conversations. They brought him up in September and used him as a reliever in the 08 September and then postseason. And it was because, hey, stuff's really, really good. That slider was a wipeout pitch. It was a wipeout for him as a starter. I think it was even a little bit better when he was a reliever and nobody had seen him before. Yeah, that to me makes a ton of sense. If you've got a guy like that, not saying you wouldn't call him up until September. Both these guys were pretty limited pro experience, and it's why they didn't come up until they came up. And so, but then their value is a little bit increased once you get into the postseason, because like you said, it's hitters haven't actually seen them before, had any kind of chance to make a real adjustment.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You mentioned Craig Kimbrell and the way Rob Thomson, you know, managed him. And just thinking about a guy that's been up and down. I mean, Craig Kimbrell for the first 6-7 years of his career looked like a reliever that could pretty easily pitch his way to Cooperstown, health permitting, right? You have a career like the one he started with, and that's where you usually end up, right? If closers make the Hall of Fame, Craig Kimbrell, I think, had a case for a long time, and maybe still does have a case. Pushing that aside, he pitched well throughout the regular season, right? 3.26 ERA, 104 whip, 94 strikeouts in 69 innings. So he's still missing bats at a good clip. Strikes out about a third of the batters he faces. The walk rate was fine. 10% is kind of typical of what you get for guys that miss a ton of bats out of the bullpen. He had a home run problem this year. That's the big skills flaw we've seen all season long. So what would you do differently with Kimbrell, seeing what he did over the course of the regular season and now looking at what's happening to him in the postseason?
So I'll start by saying, to give Thomson at least an ounce of credit here, Kimbrell was going to pitch at some point. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you don't use Kimbrell in this game at all. I just would have him lower in the bullpen pecking order. But to me, the Kimbrell problem, he had those first 5 years or so where he was just lights out, right? He did everything. He missed a ton of bats. He didn't walk guys. He limited hard contact. He limited contact, period, because he was striking out so many guys. He hasn't been that guy in close to a decade, really. I think his last really elite year like that was the year in Boston, where he had a 1.5 ERA. And then since then, it's been, you know, there's been some ups and downs within, but a lot of variance, a lot of indigestion, shall we say. The problem is now he's had some homer prone years along the way. This wasn't the first one. This might have been the worst one. And he doesn't have particularly good command or even control at this point. Like, a 10% walk rate, but he never gives up a home run. Okay, it's fine. A 10% walk rate and you're pretty homer prone. Yeah, that's where I'm, you know what, you're not that guy. I think Thomson still treats him like he's that guy, the capital C closer for the high leverage situations. And to me, that's the problem, is Kimbrell is not the guy you want to bring in first or even second in these high leverage situations. And again, acknowledge, they were deep in the bullpen. Every reliever is going to get used at some point. It is literally, last night was just a question of order. I'm a little more concerned at how much he goes to Kimbrell. It's like, well, this is a save situation. I'm like, nobody cares about the save situation in the postseason. It's the win. You need to get the next three outs, or however many outs you're asking that reliever to get. And Kimbrell isn't always the best choice for that anymore. He kind of hasn't been for a few years, but I feel like Thompson still treats him like he's Craig Kimbrell, closer, all-star, guy who gets Cy Young votes, and he's just not that guy anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I think the order in which they use their relievers, a tweak would make a lot of sense. And it's like, well, Jeff Hoffman got out of the jam when Ranger Suarez left the game. There's a runner on third base. Hoffman got out of that jam, got the final two outs, run didn't score. That was a big spot. If you don't use Kimbrell late, you may have to consider using him in a situation more like that and then kind of bumping Hoffman a little back further in the game. Obviously, you're going to use Alvarado really late. You're going to use Soto really late because those guys are filthy. Kirkering's part of that mix too. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you could almost just one-for-one flip Hoffman, and then given the flaws that we're seeing from Kimbrell, if you feel worse about using Kimbrell in a situation where someone's already on base, given the home run problem.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Or I don't want him coming in with one or two guys on base because he could come in and walk the first two batters.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I was talking to a longtime reader who lives in the area who I've gotten to know super, super well. And Dean and I were texting a little bit. He reached out after the game with an unrelated question, but we were just kind of going through it a little bit. And he essentially asked, I'm paraphrasing this a little bit, but he's like, why didn't he use Sir Anthony Dominguez? I'm like, I think he's kind of lost faith in him because Sir Anthony was banged up and not great earlier in the season. I feel like that feels to me like that knocked him way down the pecking order, maybe more than it should be, because this is where the recency stuff does matter to me. It's how is the guy's stuff command kind of right now? Those are things that do change a lot. And this to me is where, you know, I sat, was in fall league with some guys who'd spent September advancing for the playoffs. You want those guys' input, you want their input, and you want your R&D guys' input. It's, okay, where is each of these, line them up, where's each of these guys, whether it's our own guys or we're looking at the other team's guys too. What are we seeing right now from these guys? I understand not every reliever is exactly the same every single outing, but there's definitely, hey, his velocity's down. Hey, his sweeper has had a little bit extra bite this time. You know, watch out for him. Or, oh, hey, maybe this should be our third righty out of the pen instead of our fourth righty. That's where I would use that on the, you're making decisions there kind of on the margins. And yeah, again, if I don't want to overdo it with Thompson, because I actually think Thompson's done a lot of things really well in the postseason. The Kimbrell thing's kind of stuck in my craw because it's part of me too. And I mean, I've said this before, I'm also married to a Phillies fan. So I've got somebody who's like living and dying with every pitch next to me as we're watching these games. And I'm like, oh my God, don't bring in Kimbrell. Are you really bringing in Kimbrell? Even when I was out in fall league and he brought in Kimbrell at one point, which I think turned out to be fine. I was like, oh my God, I need a Tums. Like this is just, right? That's just who he is.
Let's go to the ALCS just for a few minutes here. Jordan Montgomery is going to take the ball again for Texas in Game 5. And it's really interesting that the questions about the Rangers' pitching, they're still simmering in a big way, right? The Astros putting up big numbers in Games 3 and 4.
Yeah, for
sure.
The
series is even at 2-2. It seems like there's a ton of pressure right now on Jordan Montgomery and Nathan Eovaldi. It's going to be the case if they get to the World Series, too. It's like, well, those are the games we definitely should win, and if we get other ones, we steal them. And maybe Max Scherzer gets right. That could change things as well. There's a lot of ways it could play out. You know, Andrew Heaney, we talked about it a bit on yesterday's pod. Four innings seemed like kind of a necessary window. Like he had to pitch well for about four innings to give them a really good chance to win that game. He didn't get out of the first.
That didn't happen. Yeah.
Full-on disaster scenario in that regard. But you wrote about Jordan Montgomery, and I've wondered about this too. Like, how does he get the results he gets? For a long time, of course, Jordan Montgomery pitched in Yankee Stadium for half his games. It's a really tough place to pitch, whether you're lefty or a righty. And mm-hmm. the results are always better than you'd expect based on stuff. So you wrote about what you missed. I mean, how do you think front offices are going to view him as a free agent this winter? I mean, there's actually an okay supply of pitching available, but given the success he's had, this looks like it could be a pretty big winner for Montgomery.
Yeah, I think so. This free agent class is interesting. I've been working on my rankings and writing guys up, and it's a pretty interesting class. I mean, so there's one guy at the top. He's in his own category, and then it's kind of everybody else. But, you know, there's a lot of pitchers in this class where they're not number one, maybe not even number two starters, but they're pretty interesting. There's definitely I'd like to have that guy at the right price for sure. So, yeah, I think it's I think Montgomery's going to do pretty well this postseason, this offseason. I mean, I think he's going to get paid. I think he should get paid as a number three starter who actually has been pretty durable. Yes, he had the Tommy John some time ago, but he's come back. He's been durable. He's been stronger. He's been throwing harder. And I will say, thinking about, would I all hypothetically invest long-term in pitcher X? The thing I often come back to is, how much does he depend on the quality of his current stuff? He's throwing 97 now. Was he going to throw 97 forever? I mean, some guys do, right? Verlander, Scherzer. I mean, Scherzer was banged up this year. Maybe not the best example, but those guys have held their stuff. A lot of guys don't. And can this guy still be effective if it's 93 and not 97? Montgomery, his velocity's crept up the last couple of years, but he's always had success because he's got deception between the four seamer and the sinker. He's got the breaking ball that makes him super effective against lefties. He's got enough changeup. He's got, that is a pitch mix to me that, and style of pitching, I think ages pretty well. And so it wouldn't surprise me if he ended up in a situation where we look and think, wow, that guy got the longest contract of non-Otani starters. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But he should, right? That's the guy. If I'm Montgomery's agent, I might be thinking more in terms of total years, even if it's a little lower on the AAV, because he's coming off a great year. He will probably never have a platform year like this again. And I'd make the argument, hey, my guy's durable and really effective. You should pay for that.
Yeah, I think you shoot for 5 years if you are representing Jordan Montgomery. Like you're playing that longer game. You're probably hoping for 20 plus million per year. And I think there could be a team out there, you know, willing to do it. I always like that the Fangraphs player pages put the scouting report tool grades on. And I don't know why this breaks my brain, Keith. I should just be used to it by now. But Jordan Montgomery hit a 55 fastball, 50 slider, 50 curve, 50 changeup, 50 command. And the future grades on everything was a 55 except for the curveball. That was only a 50. And the future value column is a 45.
Yeah.
Look at those numbers. I'm like, wait, everything's a 5. Why is the overall a 4? Why is the sum of the parts worse than the parts? Especially, like, this almost seems like a pitcher like Montgomery should almost be the kind of guy that has, you know, 45 everything across the board and maybe 50 command or whatever the actual grade is. And then the overall grade would be higher because you're like, he makes it work. Like, and the individual parts, none of those individual parts necessarily explain it. There's something else, deception, tunneling, you know, whatever the full explanation is, that's what makes him play up. It's like backwards given the way the results have played out.
Yeah. I wonder, I don't want to speak for them, because I don't know how they're, you know, if that was just subjectively put in as the future value grade or if there was something else that went into it. But I mean, I was very light on Montgomery also, so I'm not criticizing anybody. I think one of the things, if you tell me you've got a pitcher where it's just fives across the board, okay, well, how's he going to miss bats, right? That's like a 20% strikeout rate guy who doesn't walk a lot of guys, but all right. So what else, right? Is he going to really keep the ball in the park? Is there anything there? It's not going to miss a lot of bats. Is it at least going to limit the hard contact, right? There's just a lot of meh. And to Montgomery's credit also, he got better. Right? I don't want it like that to get lost. He went up about 3 to 4 miles an hour, I think more like 3 average velocity. That's a thing, that, right? That is a big deal. But the formula he had before was also working, and that's not nothing. So
yeah.
And to me, that, I mean, maybe we just kind of all missed. He was not, I don't think he was ever a highly ranked prospect anywhere. Like, I don't think my friends over, you know, Fangraphs, MLB, we all know each other. We all talk. You know, I don't think any of us ever ranked him like as a top 100 guy. Obviously, in hindsight, he belonged on a list like that. But that's because I think those guys are really, they're hard to evaluate. Like, I didn't know, say, scouts who were super in on Montgomery either. I got a lot of, it's like a fifth starter type, right? Because you just see the unexciting velocity and the, you know, what's the out pitch? What's the formula here? You know, he gets ground balls. He's not an elite ground ball. There's nothing about him that either sitting in the stands or a cursory look through his stat lines, track record, getting to the majors, especially that you'd say, whoa, right? This guy's going to end up being, you know, a 3-4 war pitcher and a, you know, obviously a great postseason and all that. It's not. My guess is you probably have to watch him a bunch of times or have access to the data that we didn't really have at the time that he first came up either. That would be pretty telling, I guess. That would be pretty different to see if we'd had access to that or if you'd had many looks to say, hey, hitters are really reacting very badly to this. This guy is throwing, you know, it's like I said, it's that four seamer sinker playing them off each other. They look almost exactly the same as they approach the plate and they really move in different directions at the end. I went to some of that in my column, not the only person to write about this, but that's what makes him really interesting. And I do think those guys, they're not super common. There is more awareness now of the effect called seam shifted wake that leads to that. And I think some teams are trying to help develop pitchers that way, or if they show a little inclination in that direction, to give them a little bit more. I don't think you can just create those guys kind of willy-nilly, but they are, this is a formula that we know works. I think we're always going to have a little bit of trouble identifying those guys because they don't fit the more common paradigms of, say, what makes you an effective starter.
So much of what you are saying about Montgomery makes me think of Justin Steele for the Cubs. I mean, the season he just put together, yeah. And expectations were low for Justin Steele, too, across the board. I don't know anybody who really thought Justin Steele was going to be more than like a back-end sort of starter, and he's going to get Cy Young votes. Like, that's going to happen. Does he do it in a similar sort of way where it's not a high ceiling, but it's just a really nice floor and a lot of things that work really well together?
I wrote about him too. So you picked two of the guys I included in pieces this fall about guys I was wrong about. Cause I've told the story a few times seeing Justin Steele. It was 2018, I think, in fall league and thinking, why can't this guy be a fifth starter? And I remember sitting with a couple of scouts too, who were like, nah, that's not going to happen. You know, and they're like, all right, fine. Yeah, fastball's pretty light. I understand, right? This is not, I understand why the skepticism. But then, you know, this whole John Lester, right, called and had him, you know, she basically changed the mix, right? And changed that, he added that cutter that made him substantially different. So yeah, I take the L on that one for sure. But also he added a pitch that made him a much different guy. And that is not to say I wasn't wrong, but those are real ways that guys get better in kind of unpredictable fashions too. A guy completely changes his swing, changes his body. Nobody saw Max Muncy, the guy with the Dodgers, turning into the player that he was. I remember seeing Max Muncy on the Cape. That's got to be like 12 years ago now, thinking, man, I wish this guy had some power because he's a pretty good hitter. But, you know, contact hitting first baseman with some OBP skills is fine. But like, what, I mean, that's just not a model, right? Play those players don't play anymore. And then he gets, obviously, what is he, a minor league free agent, waiver claim, whatever, ends up with the Dodgers. They change his swing. Well, okay, sure. I don't feel bad for not seeing that coming, but we also do need to acknowledge, you know, and I try to do this a little bit more in prospect write-ups. Okay, with this particular change, which is not likely, but this is kind of something you could consider, like, hey, don't be surprised if this path that is, I'm drawing in the air here, that is just sort of like steady but very unexciting growth, suddenly takes a big jump, some hockey stick style jump forward, because that's what a lot of these stories are. And I think these are great stories. I like being wrong on those because they're really interesting to talk about in their success stories. It's much more fun to talk about those than the failures. But to me, Steele is more in that column, something very significant changed that made him different, better, more effective, versus Montgomery, where it's, nah, that guy was always pretty good. I just missed it.
Yeah, it's a much smaller pitch mix, though, for Justin Steele, too. You'd think to get by this way, he's got to have four or five pitches. I mean, Jordan Montgomery has that deeper arsenal. And I think when you try and forecast how a pitcher is going to age when you don't have premium stuff, the number of pitches is one of those things you look at and say, at least there's different things this guy can try. There's ways to keep hitters guessing and off balance if command is good and the arsenal is at least good enough to maybe turn the lineup over twice. Like, that's the lower end outcome at the end of a multi-year contract for a lot of players.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
I wanted to ask you about Yordan Álvarez just a little bit. I mean, he hits everything. And as I mentioned earlier, lefty on lefty, those matchups, they can vary quite a bit, and I think a lot is being made of just how much success Alvarez is having against lefties this postseason. This is not a surprise, though. He has done nothing but hit anyone and everything in the big leagues. I mean, his career splits against lefties, they're even better than Bryce Harper's. 301, 382, 565 for the slash line, 21.5% K rate, walk rate over 10%. It's a 158 WRC plus. It's an absurd split against lefties. And Yordan Álvarez, Keith, you look at all-time leaderboards and you start looking at some of the rate stats like WRC+, you see him among all-time greats, inner circle Hall of Famers. That's the type of hitter he is. And I think now that we've seen the Astros deep into the postseason, like every year of his career, the appreciation for what Yordan Álvarez does as a hitter, it's finally reaching the level that it should be at. You think about the way people talked about Juan Soto a couple of years ago, and Juan Soto's still great.
He's pretty
Alvarez
good.
Belongs in a conversation like that, and I think he's just finally getting there for some folks. I know for people who've been around the game, for fantasy players, for Astros fans, even people who watch the AL West a lot.
Dodgers
fans. He's not a secret. Dodgers fans probably lose a little sleep over it just because, I mean, Josh Fields for Yordan Álvarez is going to go down as an all-time brutal trade. How on earth is Yordan Álvarez this good? Especially lefty on lefty, given all the things people say about the difficulty of that matchup and trying to steer young hitters away and trying to platoon guys. I mean, like, how can you be that good in those matchups?
I think it's a combination of, and I mean, God, these last 2 years he's had too, really since he got, he was pretty nicked up for a while. And I'm pretty sure, I'm going off memory here, I'm pretty sure the Dodgers were very concerned about his long-term durability because he had knee issues going way back, and he was young to have knee issues and then missed basically all of 2020, I think, as a result of that. But to why he's so good, I think it's a combination of, it's a really simple swing, and he is as strong as it gets, right? He can overpower a lot of stuff. And I think that is, I don't think it's much more than that. Like, his pitch recognition is good. His ball strike recognition is good. And they have all improved over the last couple of years as well. And he is able to, when he squares something up, it's extremely hard, right? There are, I don't think there are many guys who make as consistently hard contact as he does. And I will say this too, the guy, the more he gets to DH, the better, the longer his career is going to be. He is not, he's a bad outfielder. I worried about the knees. I worry about the body. I don't worry about the bat. He's going to hit. And I think this is a guy who could, it could be the David Ortiz, right? That being a DH lets him play kind of forever. And that's great.
Yeah. I mean, so Yordan Alvarez debuted for the Astros back in 2019. Only yep. Aaron Judge and Mike Trout have been better by a WRC plus during that time. That's it. That's the list.
I mean, imagine if Yordan Alvarez could play a position. Now, obviously, this is a whole lot, right? The Dodgers probably don't trade him in that scenario. I remember seeing Alvarez at one point in the minors and thinking, this guy can really hit, but God, what? There's nowhere to play him. It's not, it's an old body. You know, there were already whispers about some knee issues, which he did eventually, I believe, have surgery on them. But then since he came back, he's basically, like, he missed a little time this year. It's not been really pretty durable and just keeps improving as a hitter. I mean, look at the cut and the strikeout rate over the last couple of years. Like, this guy is bat alone. If MVP were really just best bat, didn't care about position, defense, et cetera. And there are some people who would like to pretend that that's the case, but it's not. He'd be a top five guy every year if it's just best bat. I guess there's probably an award for that somewhere.
Best bat, silver slugger, I guess, but like right? platinum sort of, slugger, kinda. Is that a thing? Yeah. They got the platinum glove, right? For the best all-around defender. They need a platinum slugger. Why not have more awards? I mean, what's the downside at this point?
Oh, I know. Good, if we're going to hand gold gloves out to everybody. Yeah.
The last part of this I just wanted to ask you about was the lefty-on-lefty fixation in general, right?
Right?
How much of that is the result of just the smaller population of left-handed pitchers that hitters get to see as they make their ascent into professional baseball? Is that why the lefty on lefty matchup is actually more difficult, or is that actually something of a myth, right? I mean, we don't talk about righty righty matchups nearly as often as we talk about lefty lefty, and there's tons of righty righty matchups. So what do you attribute that to?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll just bring up too, I mentioned Alec Bohm earlier and how I don't think he should be batting fourth. I mean, Alec Bohm is basically does all of his damage against lefties, a right-handed hitter. And look, I still hold out hope that he's going to continue to improve. He improved a lot as a hitter, I think, against lefties this year. But yeah, 324 OBP, 377 slug this year against righties, 335 OBP, so about the same. 594 slug against lefties this year. He had 12 homers against lefties and 8 against righties, even though he faced righties 2.5 times more often.
Like, right.
Those are also real. Like, most right-handers will show you some platoon split. Some it's more extreme than others. And if Alec Bohm never improves from this, he's a platoon player. He shouldn't be playing every day against righties. Fortunately for him and the Phillies, he's improved quite a bit on defense this year. I think you've seen a lot of that this postseason. I bring him up as nobody's really talking about that. Certainly not the broadcasters, half of whom seem to not know who the players are. But just in general, I don't see a ton of discussion except for some Phillies fans who are obviously really into this and really paying attention. Several of whom, I made some comment about Bohm having an at-bat last night in the Thursday night game where he basically saw 5 pitches that should have been called strikes, or at least close enough, and he watched them all. And he did eventually get called out. And I was like, well, you earned that one, buddy. I don't know how, took the first 2 strikes and then took 2 more pitches that were basically right on the edge of the strike zone, understanding that is like some sort of quantum space there that's not super well defined. You got to go after one of those, in my opinion. So
I mentioned earlier,
go ahead. I'm rambling a little bit too.
I'd mentioned earlier that you want multiple years of lefty lefty, righty righty, the handedness splits. You want more, because a season is just too noisy. If you go back 3 full regular seasons, back to 2021, over that 3-year span, righty-righty splits, Alec Bohm, among hitters that have had 1,000 plate appearances, has the third worst WRC+. The only righties who've been worse, Miguel Rojas, Randall Grichuk. We've known Randall Grichuk's had that flaw forever, right? Like,
forever.
That's who he is. Javi Baez is right near in that range. Kike Hernandez, I think Kike Hernandez exactly is the kind of guy you put him in against lefties. You don't really use him against righties unless you have to. And if you play him against righties, you bury him in the lineup.
No, I just scared the cat. And that's fine, right? Those are useful players, especially, thank goodness, now we've got, right, you can have no more than 13 pitchers on your postseason roster. Hooray for the platoon bat. Mm-hmm. I'm all about that. I would rather see, first of all, I like seeing some pinch hitting and a little bit of in-game strategy. That's always kind of interesting. Oh, is that okay? Well, there were one the other night, one of the games the Phillies won where the D-backs put in Pavin Smith, So Thompson went to the bullpen, I think, for Alvarado. And so then Smith just vanished, right? Because then he put in a right-handed pitch, which I always think is kind of fun. It's like, you were never really here. Like, that's kind of, I'm into, right? Larger benches. And there's a absolute, there should be a place. I want there to be a place for guys like that. Flawed players like that still can have a lot of value. And if that's what Alec Bohm turns into, obviously a disappointment for the third overall pick, but he could play a long time as a platoon bat who can play third and first and obviously really mashes lefties. I still hope there's more. I hope there's another gear there. This was all in service of your point. We talk a ton about lefties who don't hit lefties. We don't talk as much about righties who don't hit righties. And that doesn't make a ton of sense to me because it's a bigger problem.
To me, it's less likely. It's possible. It's always possible for anyone to improve. It's less likely for Alec Bohm to get better in a righty versus righty split than it is for a struggling lefty to get better in a lefty versus lefty split, because there's less of a track record. Bohm's had more chances already to get better, is what I'm saying. There's been more volume already. So if I had to bet on one of those things happening, first off, I'd want to know that the team's actually going to give a guy a chance to continue facing lefties if he's struggled in the past. But I think this is what, if you're a rebuilding team especially, and you've got young players, young left-handed hitters, and you're platooning them, you are doing a huge disservice. You're missing an opportunity for guys to actually get better and just be flat-out everyday players, which seems silly to me. Like, I don't know why you'd want to limit development that way.
No, I agree. I completely agree. I am in favor. I can see guys in the minors and say, I think he's going to be a platoon player. Just like I see starters in the minors say, I think he's going to be a reliever. You don't develop them that way, right? If you are running player development, you say, we're developing every guy as a potential regular. We're developing as many guys as we possibly can as starters, even if we believe DJ Hurst, who was traded, he was in the Jaime Candelario trade from the Cubs to the Nats. He's off to a really good start in fall league. A couple of Nats fans were essentially arguing with me, why do you think this guy can't be a starter? I'm like, it's two pitches. It's below average command. He cannot spin anything. I would still start him. He's starting in the fall league. When they send him out to, I assume he'll start next year at AAA, he should be starting. Maybe they give him a few starts in the big leagues. One, let him prove you wrong. Two, nobody got better by not pitching, right? You pitch. The more you pitch, the more, you know what? Let guys try to face lineups three times in the minors. So they have to work on figuring out different ways to get opposing hitters out. I hate this idea. It's like, well, we're just going to go twice through the order in the minors. Look, that's not, no, that's not how. That's a strategy for the big leagues. That's not a development strategy. So you want to develop all these guys for the best case scenario, because some guys will surprise you. And I think it even sets them up better if they have to take a reduced role.
Yeah. If you get those extra reps, you face a lineup the third time, you're maxing out pitch counts and you're building up arm strength, but you're also developing the feel, the stuff, the command, everything you need to possibly have a fourth or a fifth or a sixth pitch or even a third pitch, whatever it is, you're maxing out your development ceiling. And that gives you a better chance of either being someone that can go through the lineup a third time later, or just being better at going through the lineup twice later when you're being managed that way, because your stuff is all better across the board because you had more reps.
Yep. Amen. Amen to all of that. I just think it's, if I were running player development, which I've never done, even when I was with the Blue Jays, it's not working player development. So I admit I'm stepping outside of what I know, but based on obviously years of talking to player development people and just my own kind of observations over time, I would very much push towards, hey, we are going to develop every pitcher who has the possibility of being a starter, even if it's a 5% chance as a starter, and every hitter gets to play. Maybe they don't play every day, but they play against the mix of guys. Every left-handed hitter, I'm not sitting my left-handed hitting prospects against lefties in the minors. In fact, I want them more than anything to play against the toughest lefties they're going to face at any point in the minors.
So let's talk Arizona Fall League for a couple minutes. Yes. I think there's a player that might tie some of this together. Kyle Manzardo. I've seen the clips. Mm-hmm. He's hit some very long home runs in the
longest
fall
one
league.
I saw.
Yep. Not surprising based on things we knew about Kyle Manzardo prior to this season. I know there was an injury this year. Of course, he got traded from the Rays to the Guardians. If you're the Guardians and you're a team that has had a multi-year problem hitting for power up and down that lineup, and Kyle Manzardo is either your opening day first baseman or he's at least part of the opening early season regular lineup, are you going to let him play every single day based on what you've seen, or do you break him in and give him those days off against lefties? Like, what should their development strategy be for him specifically, just based on what you've seen from him as a hitter and what he's been able to accomplish as he's moved through the minor leagues?
At the time of the trade, so Manzardo traded for Aaron Civale, which I think is going to turn out to be a good trade for both sides. Manzardo was hurt and had not been great earlier in the season. And I think talking to Cleveland folks, it doesn't sound like they made any really big changes. They barely had him. But this, he looks like he's taking a kind of a step forward here. It's like, oh, okay, this is the guy we thought he was going to be. And so that is, to me, a great, great sign for Cleveland. This is the type of hitting prospect they've just not had in forever. They develop a lot of hitters. They don't develop any power. And I think a lot of their hitting prospects have kind of underwhelmed because they haven't advanced in terms, they haven't developed enough power for the hit tool to even really play for them. And so I think Manzardo, I mean, it's not surprising they had to go outside the organization to find a guy like that. But I actually think this little step forward we're seeing in power is legit. 6-21 games in AAA after the trade, after he came off the injured list. Now, Arizona, everybody hits out there and the ball flies farther out there and the pitching sucks. Yeah, it really sucks, actually. I was like, do I need to walk that back? No, actually, the pitching sucks. Yeah, it's 5 homers in 11 games. Don't think he's going to do that. It's like an 80-homer pace in the big leagues. I don't think he's that. But do I feel better? Last year, he had 22 homers in 93 games. But it was like, yeah, it's probably a little bit more hard contact doubles. So, now I'm in. This is a 25-plus homer guy. He's a top 50 prospect in baseball. Not a great defensive first baseman. That's probably the biggest flaw I can say here. But and I don't know if I would. He basically spent the year in AAA, right? He had 97 games around a stint on the injured list. He did not have great performance there until after the trade and after he was healthy, after he was off the injured list. Do I start him in AAA again next year, or do I push him? I probably push him a little bit. I don't like letting spring training be any kind of determining factor. I would say more in terms of, hey, if we get to, if we're towards the end of spring training, go into spring training with the idea of this is probably going to be his job. And just make sure he plays up to it, seems ready, working well with the coaching staff. He's obviously not been in the big leagues before, but kind of that's our intention here. And something would really have to derail it. He gets hurt. He seems overwhelmed. You discover some particular weakness that he needs to work on, et cetera. I'd probably go into it with that mindset because he's already spent the year at AAA. And with the year at AAA, and he's going to, you know, play what, 20, 30 games in fall league too? It's probably enough. I don't know why you're holding him back at that point. And I'm not an advocate of overly rushing players to the big leagues. Like if I thought there was a real reason to keep him in the minors, I would argue that if he'd not spent time in AAA, for example, I think that would be a very different story, but that's not the case.
Yeah. I just think given the needs, given what he's shown and this recent run in the fall league tacked onto that season, I think there's enough there to make that plan to make him part of the opening day lineup. You saw Chase DeLauder, who missed a good chunk of the season with a foot injury and by numbers looked great once he finally came back healthy. You got to look at him and you wrote about some concerns with his swing. And I think the broader question I have with DeLauder would be like, do you have reason to believe that those are going to take a lot of time to fix or that they're not even correctable at all? Like, what do you think the path really is?
Yeah, there was a lot of, it was pretty interesting. A lot of scouts voicing concerns like, is that going to work? Because all this guy's ever done is hit when he's been healthy. Now he had the foot injury that recurred. And so obviously he was, we didn't see him play very, he didn't play for over a year between March of his draft year versus when he come back July or so of this year, did not play. And then was at levels that were probably a little easy for a little lower for him because they were trying to ease him back in, but all he's done is hit everywhere. I didn't like the swing in college. I don't like it now. I think he opens his front hip way too early. I think he has to cheat a little bit to get to better velocity. And I think that he's going to have some of those left on left problems. You open your hip like that, guys are going to just spin breaking balls away from him, better breaking balls. And I think he's really going to struggle with those. That is all good, except if he just keeps hitting, right? You just keep pushing him. There are guys who succeed with really unusual swings. I was talking to someone about Dustin Pedroia the other day, is just a guy like that. None of that should have worked. right? And it did for a really long time. He would have been probably been a Hall of Famer if his body hadn't given out on him, right? There are guys who do it with really unusual swings. And I would, again, I wouldn't change anything with DeLauder until he struggles. Now, if he gets to a point where he struggles, then you have to work on some stuff. I don't know how much those are fixable, right? I'm saying these are big things with his swing that in general do not work. They are, in general, things that inhibit somebody from hitting major league pitching. If he just keeps on hitting, I wouldn't change a thing. Let him get to the big leagues. If he struggles there, fine. Then we have to make a change. He may hit all the way up through the minors. He may even continue to hit through the majors. I'm betting against that, obviously. But I would definitely say let him be until he has any kind of trouble at some point. Maybe it's AA, maybe it's AAA. I don't know when it'll be. I do think at some point he'll run into better quality pitching. We saw that with Colton Cowser, who didn't even have real swing issues, but just had real pitch recognition issues. And he got to the majors and he was kind of terrible. I'm not giving up on Colton Cowser, but that's an example of a guy who hit all the way up until he just didn't. And if that's the case with DeLauder, you just let him go. Don't change anything until you absolutely have to.
I think of Keston Hira as someone who watched the Brewers a lot, as someone that hit and then didn't, and then they couldn't quite fix it, and now he's a free agent. Like, he's gone.
You know, that to me, that's a great example the other direction. They did change his swing in the worst possible way to try to get him to hit for more power and cost him ability to hit. I remember seeing him at one point in the big leagues, you're like, oh my God, what the heck did they just do here? Like, he looked like he was, I don't even know how to describe it, right? It was just sort of this like tomahawk, but upwards, like just trying to chop the ball up. I don't even know what to call it. It was
a strange outcome based on the player he was supposed to be. Like, it really was, because correct me if I'm wrong, when Keston Hira was drafted, the biggest concern was that his arm was going to prevent him from playing defense anywhere. And even if his arm was healthy, he wasn't necessarily going to be a good defender anywhere. But the thing he was going to do was spray the ball all over the park and get to a reasonable amount of power. I think the expectation was something like 15 home runs annually for Keston Hira, maybe 20 in his peak seasons.
It was always hit.
Hit 300 with a good OBP because he could just use the whole field.
I remember being a little bit of a skeptic on him in the draft and having a lot of scouts and some analysts too, just like, this guy just really hits everywhere. And then he got to the big leagues fairly quickly and never hit. I mean, God, this guy hit, 330, 348, 442. They're just batting averages. I understand. I wrote a book about that stuff. This guy raked in college in absolutely everywhere he played. And for fork's sake, man, you could just like see a break where it's just like, oh, this is where they screwed with his swing. Yep. Right. But basically, right as he got to the big leagues. Well, he had that one like half season, his first season, but he struck out a ton. That was the warning. It's like, oh, wait a minute. This was this super high contact guy. What happened? And yeah, he never recovered. I mean, that's why you don't touch Chase DeLauder, right? You leave DeLauder alone. And I say that as someone who is a skeptic because of these mechanical issues. You let him be until he fails. Do not change guys until they show you some reason that you have to do so. This is obvious. I don't have some kind of sage approach here, right? But teams do this stuff. Oh, that's not going to work, so we got to change it. No. Don't change it until it stops working or he gets hurt. That's really more of a pitcher thing. You know, and that's where you change a role. I was writing a little bit about Luis Severino as a free agent. I've been saying forever that guy needs to go to the bullpen. He's hurt all the time. And then this year, he was also just not very good. My God, put this poor guy in the bullpen. I think he might be really good there. Somebody might try to sign him as a starter. Maybe he'll find some success again. But the number of injuries and now some struggles he's had, that's a point where you say, we're going to make a change.
We've seen less talented pitchers than Severino go places on a one-year deal and put it back together and then come back and get paid the following year. Like, I think that's still, if you're Severino, you still have to believe that's a possibility. But if that doesn't work, the best thing about taking a one-year flyer on Luis Severino is if you go through 3 months and he doesn't look good as a starter, if he looks more like he did this year for most of the year, Throw him in the bullpen.
Throw him in the bullpen.
He'll pinch well in the pen for a month, and if you're not a contender yourself, there will be a dozen teams that want that guy in their late innings because he's filthy.
And I wonder, I'm not around the club. Now I'm just speculating, really speculating. This guy used to be, like, I saw him quite a bit in the minors and was always questioning like, that delivery's not going to hold up. It's all arm. He's not using his lower half enough. I remember sitting with a scout who's actually since passed away, just turned around to me. We were in Trenton, double-A affiliate of the Yankees at the time. And he said, basically, that's not going to work. He's not using his lower half at all. And Severino just kept breaking down. Also, Severino as a prospect in that first year and a half or so in the big leagues, he was confident. Like he looked like he was, I can get you out three different ways. You can't touch me. He doesn't look like that guy anymore. Obviously, it's right. You're not having success. You're not going to be as confident, right? I wonder if you put him in a different role, bullpen, bulk, whatever. He gets a little bit of that back and is more like attack. Because like you said, the stuff's still filthy. The velocity's still there. He should be. It is hard to believe when you look at the quality of the stuff that he was as bad as he was last year. Like that doesn't make sense at all. And I feel bad for him. It probably cost him a ton of money. Somebody should give him the 1 year flyer. And if I were a team that just could use any sort of bullpen help, a would be contender with a lot of openings in the bullpen, I'd say, come to us. We'll work this out. We'll get you. You can be a one inning closer if you want, or we could use you in a multiple inning role if you think you're up for that. We've got opportunities for you, and then you can go back out in the market next winter. And you know what? If you turn out to be a really good late game reliever, those guys get paid too.
Yeah, I think you could have, 5+ years of elite reliever if that's where you're at, because you're starting with a guy that averaged 96.5 with his fastball as a starter. So you add a couple ticks to that. Maybe you change up the secondaries a little bit. Like those are going to play up even more in that shorter role too. That's a ridiculous floor. I hope we're not at that point where they have to do that yet, but if they go that route, it's going to work out just fine. We'll probably get to a few more guys you saw because we're running up on a full hour. And you wrote two great pieces from the Fall League. People can check those out. Thank if they're you. Subscribers to The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/baseball show gets you a subscriber. If you don't have that already, it's $2 a month for the first year to get in the door. You can find us on X/Twitter. You can find Keith at Keith Law. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. Enjoy the baseball this weekend. We're back with you on Monday.